Oft she begged for death. All the Maester's arts were powerless against her fever, if indeed we can call such a horror by such a commonplace name. The simplest way to say it is that the poor child was cooking from within. Her flesh grew darker and darker, and then began to crack, until her skin resembled nothing so much, Seven save me, as pork cracklings. Thin tendrils of smoke issued from her mouth, her nose, even most obscenely from her nether lips. By then she had ceased to speak, though the things within her continued to move. Her very eyes cooked within her skull and finally burst, like two eggs left in a pot of boiling water for too long. I thought that was the most hideous thing that I should ever see, but I was quickly disabused of the notion, for a worse horror was awaiting me. That came when Bennifer and I lowered the poor child into a tub and covered her with ice. The shock of that immersion stopped her heart at once, I tell myself. If so, that was a mercy, for that was when the things inside her came out. The things. Mother have mercy, I do not know how to speak of them. They were worms with faces, snakes with hands, twisting, slimy, unspeakable things that seemed to writhe and pulse and squirm as they came bursting from her flesh. Some were no bigger than my little finger, but one at least was as long as my arm. Oh, warrior, protect me, the sounds they made. They died, though. I must remember that, cling to that. Whatever they might have been, they were creatures of heat and fire, and they did not love the ice. Oh, no. One after another they thrashed and writhed and died before my eyes, thank the Seven. I will not presume to give them names. They were horrors. The first part of Septon Barth's account ends there, but some days later he returned and resumed. Princess Aria is gone, but not forgotten. The faithful pray for her sweet soul every morn and every night. Outside the septs, the same questions are on every lip. But the princess was missing for more than a year. Where could she have gone? What could have happened to her? What brought her home? Was Beleriand the monster believed to haunt the velvet hills of Andalus? Did his flames start the fire that swept across the disputed lands? Could the black dread have flown as far as Astapor to be the dragon in the pit? No, and no, and no. These are fables. If we put aside such distractions, however, the mystery remains. Where did Aria Targaryen go after fleeing Dragonstone? Queen Rhaena's first thought was that she had flown to King's Landing. The princess had made no secret of her wish to return to court. When that proved wrong, Rhaena next looked to Fair Isle and Old Town. Both made sense, after a fashion, but Aria was not to be found at either place, nor anywhere in Westeros. Others, including the Queen and myself, took this to mean that the princess had flown east, not west, and would be found somewhere in Essos. The girl might well have thought the Free Cities to be beyond her mother's grasp, and Queen Alysanne in particular seemed convinced that Aria was fleeing her mother as much as Dragonstone itself. Yet Lord Rigo's agents and informers could find no hint of her across the narrow sea, nor even a whisper of her dragon. Why? Though I can offer no certain proof, I can suggest an answer. It seems to me that we have all been asking the wrong question. Aria Targaryen was still well shy of her 13th name day on the morning she slipped from her mother's castle. Though no stranger to dragons, she had never ridden one before, and for reasons we may never understand, she chose Beleriand as her mount, instead of any one of the younger and more tractable dragons she might have claimed. Driven as she was by her conflicts with her mother, mayhaps she simply wanted a beast larger and more fearsome than Queen Rhaena's Dreamfire. It might also have been a desire to tame the beast that had slain her father and his own dragon, though Princess Aria had never known her father, and it is hard to know what feelings she might have had about him and his death. Regardless of her reasons, the choice was made. The princess might well have intended to fly to King's Landing, just as her mother suspected. It might have been her thought to seek out her twin sister in Old Town, or to go seeking after Lady Alyssa Farman, who had once promised to take her adventuring. Whatever her plans, they did not matter. It is one thing to leap upon a dragon, and quite another to bend him to your will, particularly a beast as old and fierce as the Black Dread. From the very start, we have asked, where did Arya take Valerian? We should have been asking, where did Valerian take Arya? Only one answer makes sense. Recall, if you will, that Valerian was the largest and oldest of the three dragons that King Aegon and his sisters rode to conquest. Vhagar and Meraxes had hatched on Dragonstone. Valerian alone had come to the island with Einar the Exile and Daenerys the Dreamer, the youngest of the five dragons they brought with them. The older dragons had died during the intervening years, but Valerian lived on, growing ever larger, fiercer, and more willful. If we discount the tales of certain sorcerers and mountebanks, as we should, he is mayhaps the only living creature in the world that knew Valyria before the doom. And that is where he took the poor doomed child clinging to his back. If she went willingly, I would be most surprised, but she had neither the knowledge nor the force of will to turn him. What befell her on Valyria, I cannot surmise. Judging from the condition in which she returned to us, I do not even care to contemplate it. The Valyrians were more than dragon lords. They practiced blood magic and other dark arts as well, delving deep into the earth for secrets best left buried, and twisting the flesh of beasts and men to fashion monstrous and unnatural chimeras. For these sins the gods in their wrath struck them down. Valyria is accursed, all men agree, and even the boldest sailor steers well clear of its smoking bones. But we would be mistaken to believe that nothing lives there now. The things we found inside Arya Targaryen live there now, I would submit, along with such other horrors as we cannot even begin to imagine. I have written here at length of how the princess died, but there is something else, something even more frightening that requires mention. Valerian had wounds as well. That enormous beast, the Black Dread, the most fearsome dragon ever to soar through the skies of Westeros, returned to King's Landing with half-healed scars that no man recalled ever having seen before, and a jagged rent down his left side almost 9 feet long, a gaping red wound from which his blood still dripped hot and smoking. The lords of Westeros are proud men, and the septons of the faith and the maesters of the citadel in their own ways are prouder still, but there is much and more of the nature of the world that we do not understand, and may never understand. Mayhaps that is a mercy. The Father made men curious, some say, to test our faith. It is my own abiding sin that whenever I come upon a door I must needs see what lies upon the farther side. But certain doors are best left unopened. Arya Targaryen went through such a door. Septon Barth's account ends there. He would never again touch upon the fate of Princess Arya in any of his writings, and even these words would be sealed away amongst his privy papers to remain undiscovered for almost 100 years. The horrors he had witnessed had a profound effect upon the Septon, however, exciting the very hunger for knowledge he called my own abiding sin. It was subsequent to this that Barth began the researches and investigations that would ultimately lead him to write Dragons, Worms, and Wyverns, Their Unnatural History, a volume that the Citadel would condemn as provocative but unsound, and that Baelor the Blessed would order expunged and destroyed. It is likely that Septon Barth discussed his suspicions with the king as well. Though the matter never came before the small council, later that same year, Jaehaerys issued a royal edict forbidding any ship suspected of having visited the Valyrian Islands or sailed the Smoking Sea from landing at any port or harbour in the Seven Kingdoms. The king's own subjects were likewise forbidden from visiting Valyria under pain of death. Not long thereafter, Valyrian became the first of the Targaryen dragons to be housed in the Dragon Pit. Its long, brick-lined tunnels sunk deep into the hillside had been fashioned after the manner of caves, and were 5 times as large as the lairs on Dragonstone. 3 younger dragons soon joined the Black Dread under the Hill of Rhaenys, whilst Vermithor and Silverwing remained at the Red Keep, close to their riders. To ascertain there would be no repetition of Princess Arya's escape on Valyrian, the king decreed that all the dragons should be guarded night and day, regardless of where they laired. A new order of guards was created for this purpose, the Dragon Keepers. 77 strong and clad in suits of gleaming black armour, their helms crested by a row of dragon scales that continued diminishing down their backs. Little and less need be said of the return of Rhaena Targaryen from Estamont after her daughter's death. By the time the raven reached her grace at Greenstone, the princess had already died and been burned. Only ashes and bones remained for her mother when Dreamfire delivered her to the Red Keep. "It would seem that I am doomed to always come too late," she said. When the king offered to have the ashes interred on Dragonstone, beside those of King Aegon and the other dead of House Targaryen, Rhaena refused. She hated Dragonstone, she reminded his grace. She wanted to fly. And so saying, she took her child's ashes high into the sky on Dreamfire and scattered them upon the winds. It was a melancholy time. Dragonstone was still hers, if she wanted it, Jaehaerys told his sister. But Rhaena refused that as well. "There is nothing there for me now but grief and ghosts." When Alysanne asked if she would return to Greenstone, Rhaena shook her head. "There's a ghost there as well. A kinder ghost, but no less sad." The king suggested that she remain with them at court, even offering her a seat on his small council. That made his sister laugh. "Oh, brother, you sweet man, I fear you would not like any counsel I might offer." Then Queen Alysanne took her sister's hand in hers and said, "You are still a young woman. If you like, we could find some kind and gentle lord who would cherish you as we do. You could have other children." That only served to bring a snarl to Rhaena's lips. She snatched her hand away from the queen's and said, "I fed my last husband to my dragon. If you make me take another, I may eat him myself." The place where King Jaehaerys settled his sister Rhaena in the end was mayhaps the most unlikely seat of all, Harrenhal. Jordan Towers, one of the last lords to remain faithful to Maegor the Cruel, had died of a congestion of the chest, and Black Harren's vast ruin had passed to his last surviving son, named after the late king. All of his older brothers having perished in King Maegor's wars, Maegor Towers was the last of his line, and sickly and impoverished as well. In a castle built to house thousands, Towers dwelt alone but for a cook and three elderly men-at-arms. "The castle has five colossal towers," the king pointed out, "and the Towers boy occupies part of one. You can have the other four." Rhaena was amused by that. "One will suffice, I am sure. I have a smaller household than he does." When Alysanne reminded her that Harrenhal too was said to have ghosts, Rhaena shrugged. "They are not my ghosts. They will not trouble me." And thus it came to pass that Rhaena Targaryen, daughter of one king, wife to two, sister to a third, spent the final years of her life in the aptly named Widow's Tower of Harrenhal, whilst across the castle yard, a sickly youth named after the king who had slain the father of her children, maintained his own household in the Tower of Dread. Curiously, we are told, in time, Rhaena and Maegor Towers came to forge a friendship of sorts. After his death in 61 AC, Rhaena took his servants into her own household and continued to maintain them until her own death. Rhaena Targaryen died in 73 AC, at 50 years of age. After the death of her daughter Arya, she never again visited King's Landing or Dragonstone, nor played any part in the ruling of the realm, though she did fly to Old Town once a year to visit with her remaining daughter, Rhaela, a scepter of the Starry Sept. Her hair of gold and silver turned white before the end, and the small folk of the Riverlands feared her as a witch. Travellers who turned up at the gates of Harrenhal in hope of hospitality were given bread and salt and the privilege of a night's shelter during those years, but not the honour of the Queen's company. Those who were fortunate spoke of glimpsing her on the castle battlements, or seeing her coming and going on her dragon, for Rhaena continued to ride Dreamfire until the end, just as she had in the beginning. When she died, King Jaehaerys ordained that she be burned at Harrenhal, and her ashes interred there. "My brother Aegon died at the hands of our uncle in the battle beneath the God's Eye," his grace said at her funeral pyre. "His wife, my sister Rhaena, was not with him at the battle. But she died that day as well." With Rhaena's death, Jaehaerys granted Harrenhal and all its lands and incomes to Sir Bywin Strong, the brother of Sir Lucamore Strong of his King's Guard, and a renowned knight in his own right. We have wandered decades ahead of our tale, however, for the stranger did not come for Rhaena Targaryen until 73 AC, and much and more was to pass in King's Landing and the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros before that, for both good and ill. In 57 AC, Jaehaerys and his queen found cause to rejoice again, when the gods blessed them with another son. Baelon, he was named, after one of the Targaryen lords who had ruled Dragonstone before the conquest, himself a second son. Though smaller than his brother Aemon at birth, the new babe was louder and lustier, and his wet nurses complained that they had never known a child to suck so hard. Only 2 days before his birth, the white ravens had flown from the citadel to announce the arrival of spring, so Baelon was immediately dubbed the Spring Prince. Prince Aemon was 2 when his brother was born, Princess Daenerys 4. The two were little alike. The princess was a lively, laughing child who bounced about the Red Keep day and night, flying everywhere on a broomstick dragon that had become her favourite toy. Mud-spattered and grass-stained, she was a trial to her mother and her maids alike, for they were forever losing track of her. Prince Aemon, on the other hand, was a very serious boy, cautious, careful, and obedient. Though he could not as yet read, he loved being read too, and Queen Alysanne, laughing, was oft heard to say that his first word had been, "Why?" As the children grew, Grand Maester Bennifer watched them closely. The wounds left by the enmity between the Conqueror's sons, Aenys and Maegor, were still fresh in the minds of many older lords, and Bennifer worried lest these two boys likewise turn on one another to bathe the realm in blood. He need not have been concerned. Save mayhaps for twins, no brothers could ever have been closer than the sons of Jaehaerys Targaryen. As soon as he grew old enough to walk, Baelon followed his brother Aemon everywhere, and tried his best to imitate him in everything he did. When Aemon was given his first wooden sword to begin his training in arms, Baelon was judged to be too young to join him. But that did not stop him. He made his own sword from a stick and rushed into the yard anyway to begin whacking at his brother, reducing their master-at-arms to helpless laughter. Thereafter, Baelon went everywhere with his stick sword, even to bed, to the despair of his mother and her maids. Prince Aemon was shy around the dragons at first, Bennifer observed, but not so Baelon, who reportedly smote Balerion on the snout the first time he entered the dragon pit. "He's either brave or mad, that one," old Sour Sam observed, and from that day forth the Spring Prince was also known as Baelon the Brave. The young princes loved their sister to distraction, it was plain to see, and Daenerys delighted in the boys, especially in telling them what to do. Grand Maester Bennifer noted something else, however. Jaehaerys loved all 3 children fiercely, but from the moment Aemon was born, the king began to speak of him as his heir, to Queen Alysanne's displeasure. "Daenerys is older," she would remind his grace. "She is first in line. She should be queen." The king would never disagree, except to say, "She shall be queen when she and Aemon marry. They will rule together just as we have." But Bennifer could see that the king's words did not entirely please the queen, as he noted in his letters. Returning once again to 57 AC, that was also the year wherein Jaehaerys dismissed Lord Miles Smallwood as Hand of the King. Though undoubtedly a leal man and well-intentioned, his lordship had shown himself to be ill-suited to the small council. As he himself would say, "I was made to sit a horse, not a cushion." An older king and wiser, this time his grace told his council that he did not intend to waste a fortnight hashing over 50 names. This time he would have the hand he wanted, Septon Barth. When Lord Corbray reminded the king of Barth's low birth, Jaehaerys shrugged off his objections. "If his father beat out swords and shot horses, so be it. A knight needs his sword. A horse needs shoes, and I need bath." The new hand of the king departed within days of his elevation, taking ship for Braavos to consult with the Sea Lord and the Iron Bank. He was accompanied by Sir Giles Morrigan and six guardsmen, but only Septon Bath took part in the discussions. The purpose of his mission was a grave one. War or peace? King Jaehaerys had great admiration for the city of Braavos, Bath told the Sea Lord. For that reason he had not come himself, understanding as he did the Free City's bitter history with Valyria and its dragon lords. If his hand was not able to settle the matter at hand amicably, however, his grace would have no choice but to come himself on Vermithor for what Bath termed vigorous discussions. When the Sea Lord inquired as to what the matter at hand might be, the Septon gave him a sad smile and said, "Is that how this must be played? We are speaking of three eggs. Need I say more?" The Sea Lord said, "I admit to nothing. If I was in possession of such eggs, however, it could only be because I purchased them. From a thief. How shall that be proved? Has this thief been seized, tried, found guilty? Braavos is a city of laws. Who is the rightful owner of these eggs? Can they show me proof of ownership?" "His Grace can show you proof of dragons." That made the Sea Lord smile. "The veiled threat. Your king is most adroit at that. Stronger than his father. More subtle than his uncle. Yes, I know what Jaehaerys could do to us if he chose. Braavosi have a long memory, and we remember the dragon lords of old. There are certain things that we might do to your king as well, however. Shall I enumerate, or do you prefer the threat veiled?"
"However it please your lordship."
"As you will. Your king could burn my city down to ash, I do not doubt. Tens of thousands would die in dragon flame. Men, women, and children. I do not have the power to wreak that sort of destruction upon Westeros. Such sellswords as I might hire would flee before your knights. My fleets could sweep yours from the sea for a time, but my ships are made of wood and wood burns. However, there is in this city a certain guild, let us say, whose members are very skilled at their chosen profession. They could not destroy King's Landing, nor fill its streets with corpses, but they could kill a few, a well-chosen few.
His Grace is protected day and night by the King's Guard.
Knights, yes. Such as the man who waits for you outside. If indeed he is still waiting. What would you say if I were to tell you that Sir Giles is already dead?"
When Septon Bath began to rise, the Sea Lord waved him back to his seat. "No, please, no need to rush away. I said, what if?"
"I did consider it. They are most skilled, as I said. Had I done so, however, you might have acted unwisely, and many more good people might have died. That is not my desire. Threats make me uncomfortable. Westerosi may be warriors, but we Braavosi are traders. Let us trade."
Septon Bath settled back down.
"What do you offer?"
"I do not have these eggs, of course," the Sea Lord said.
"You cannot prove elsewise.
If I did have them, however—"
"Well, until they hatch, they are but stones. Would your king begrudge me three pretty stones? Now, if I had three chickens, I might understand his concern. I do admire your Jaehaerys, though. He is a great improvement on his uncle, and Braavos does not wish to see him so unhappy. So, instead of stones, let me offer gold."
And with that, the real bargaining began.
There are those even today who would insist that Septon Bath was made a fool of by the Sea Lord, that he was lied to, cheated, and humiliated. They point to the fact that he returned to King's Landing without a single dragon's egg. This is true. What he did bring back was not of inconsiderable value, however. At the Sea Lord's urging, the Iron Bank of Braavos forgave the entire remaining principal of its loan to the Iron Throne. At a stroke, the Crown's debt had been cut in half. "And all at the cost of three stones," Bath told the king. "The Sea Lord had best hope that they remain stones," Jaehaerys said. "If I should hear so much as a whisper of chickens, his palace will be the first to burn." The agreement with the Iron Bank would have great impact for all the people of the realm over the coming years and decades, though the extent of that was not immediately apparent. The king's shrewd master of coin, Rigo Draz, pored over the Crown's debts and incomes carefully after Septon Bath's return, and concluded that the coin that would previously have had to be sent to Braavos could now be safely diverted to a project the king had long wished to undertake at home, further improvements to King's Landing. Jaehaerys had widened and straightened the streets of the city and put down cobblestones where previously there had been mud. But much and more remained to be done. King's Landing in its present state could not compare to Old Town, nor even Lannisport, let alone the splendid free cities across the narrow sea. His Grace was determined that it should. Accordingly, he set out plans for a series of drains and sewers to carry the city's offal and night soil under the streets to the river. Septon Bath drew the king's attention to an even more urgent problem. King's Landing's drinking water was fit only for horses and swine, in the opinion of many. The river water was muddy, and the king's new sewers would soon make it worse. The waters of the Blackwater Bay were brackish at the best of times, and salty at the worst. Whilst the king and his court and the city's highborn drank ale and mead and wine, these foul waters were oft the only choice for the poor. To address the problem, Bath proposed sinking wells, some inside the city proper and others to the north beyond the walls. A series of glazed clay pipes and tunnels would carry the fresh water into the city, where it would be stored in four huge cisterns and made available to the small folk from public fountains in certain squares and crossroads. Bath's scheme was costly, beyond a doubt, and Rigo Draz and King Jaehaerys balked at the expense, until Queen Alysanne served each of them a tankard of river water at the next council meeting and dared them to drink of it. The water went undrunk, but the wells and pipes were soon approved. Construction would require more than a dozen years, but in the end, the Queen's fountains provided clean water for Kingslanders for many generations to come. Several years had passed since the king had last made a progress, so plans were laid in 58 AC for Jaehaerys and Alysanne to make their first visit to Winterfell and the north. Their dragons would be with them, of course, but beyond the Neck, the distances were great and the roads poor, and the king had grown tired of flying ahead and waiting for his escort to catch up. This time, he decreed, his king's guard, servants and retainers would go ahead of him to make things ready for his arrival. And thus it was that three ships set sail from King's Landing for White Harbour, where he and the queen were to make their first stop. The gods and the free cities had other plans, however. Even as the king's ships were beating their way north, envoys from Pentos and Tyrosh called upon his grace in the Red Keep. The two cities had been at war for 3 years, and were now desirous of making peace, but could not agree on where they might meet to discuss terms. The conflict had caused serious disruption to trade upon the narrow sea, to the extent that King Jaehaerys had offered both cities his help in ending their hostilities. After long discussion, the Archon of Tyrosh and the Prince of Pentos had agreed to meet in King's Landing to settle their differences, provided that Jaehaerys would act as an intermediary between them and guarantee the terms of any resulting treaty. It was a proposal that neither the king nor his council felt he could refuse, but it would mean postponing his grace's planned progress to the north, and there was concern that the notoriously prickly Lord of Winterfell might take that for a slight. Queen Alysanne provided the solution. She would go ahead, as planned, alone, whilst the king played host to the prince and Archon. Jaehaerys could join her at Winterfell as soon as the peace had been concluded, and so it was agreed. Queen Alysanne's travels began in the city of White Harbour, where tens of thousands of northerners turned out to cheer her and gape at Silverwing with awe, and a bit of terror. It was the first time any of them had seen a dragon. The size of the crowds surprised even their lord. "I had not known there were so many small folk in the city," Theomore Manderley is reported to have said. "Where did they all come from?" The Manderleys were unique amongst the great houses of the north. Having originated in the Reach centuries before, they had found refuge near the mouth of the White Knife, when rivals drove them from their rich lands along the Mander. Though fiercely loyal to the Starks of Winterfell, they had brought their own gods with them from the south and still worshipped the Seven and kept the traditions of knighthood. Alysanne Targaryen, ever desirous of binding the Seven Kingdoms closer together, saw an opportunity in Lord Theomore's famously large family and promptly set about arranging marriages. By the time she took her leave, two of her ladies-in-waiting had been betrothed to his lordship's younger sons, and a third to a nephew. His eldest daughter and three nieces, meanwhile, had been added to the Queen's own party, with the understanding that they would travel south with her, and there be pledged to suitable lords and knights of the King's court. Lord Manderley entertained the Queen lavishly. At the welcoming feast an entire aurochs was roasted, and his lordship's daughter Jessamine acted as the Queen's cup-bearer, filling her tankard with a strong northern ale that her grace pronounced finer than any wine she had ever tasted. Manderley also staged a small tourney in the Queen's honour to show the prowess of his knights. One of the fighters, though no knight, was revealed to be a woman, a wildling girl who had been captured by rangers north of the wall and given to one of Lord Manderley's household knights to foster. Delighted by the girl's daring, Alisanne summoned her own sworn shield, Jonquil Dark, and the wildling and the Scarlet Shadow duelled spear against sword, whilst the Northmen roared in approval. A few days later, the Queen convened her women's court in Lord Manderley's own hall, a thing hitherto unheard of in the North, and more than 200 women and girls gathered to share their thoughts, concerns, and grievances with Her Grace. After taking leave of White Harbour, the Queen's retinue sailed up the White Knife to its rapids, then proceeded overland to Winterfell, whilst Alisanne herself flew ahead on Silverwing. The warmth of her reception at White Harbour was not to be duplicated at the ancient seat of the kings in the north, where Alaric Stark and his sons alone emerged to greet her when her dragon landed before his castle gates. Lord Alaric had a flinty reputation. A hard man, people said, stern and unforgiving, tight-fisted almost to the point of being niggardly, humourless, joyless, cold. Even Theomore Manderley, who was his bannerman, had not disagreed. Stark was well respected in the north, he said, but not loved. Lord Manderley's fool had put it elsewise. Methinks Lord Alaric has not moved his bowels since he was 12. Her reception at Winterfell did nothing to disabuse the Queen's fears as to what she might expect from House Stark. Even before dismounting to bend the knee, Lord Alaric looked askance at Her Grace's clothing and said, "I hope you brought something warmer than that." He then proceeded to declare that he did not want her dragon inside his walls. "I've not seen Harrenhal, but I know what happened there." Her knights and ladies he would receive when they got here. And the king, too, if he can find the way. But they should not overstay their welcome. "This is the north, and winter is coming. We cannot feed 1,000 men for long." When the queen assured him that only 1/10 that number would be coming, Lord Alaric grunted and said, "That's good. Fewer would be even better." As had been feared, he was plainly unhappy that King Jaehaerys had not deigned to accompany her, and confessed to being uncertain how to entertain a queen. "If you are expecting balls and masks and dances, you have come to the wrong place." Lord Alaric had lost his wife 3 years earlier. When the queen expressed regret that she had never had the pleasure of meeting Lady Stark, the Northman said, "She was a Mormont of Bear Isle, and no lady by your lights, but she took an axe to a pack of wolves when she was 12, killed 2 of them, and sewed a cloak from their skins. She gave me 2 strong sons as well, and a daughter as sweet to look upon as any of your Southron ladies." When Her Grace suggested that she would be pleased to help arrange marriages for his sons to the daughters of great Southern lords, Lord Stark refused brusquely. "We keep the old gods in the north," he told the queen. "When my boys take a wife, they will wed before a heart tree, not in some Southron sept." Alisanne Targaryen did not yield easily, however. "The lords of the south honoured the old gods as well as the new," she told Lord Alaric. "Most every castle that she knew had a godswood as well as a sept, and there were still certain houses that had never accepted the 7, no more than the Northmen had, the Blackwoods in the Riverlands chief amongst them, and mayhaps as many as 12 more." Even a lord as stern and flinty as Alaric Stark found himself helpless before Queen Alisanne's stubborn charm. He allowed that he would think on what she said, and raise the matter with his sons. The longer the queen stayed, the more Lord Alaric warmed to her, and in time Alisanne came to realize that not everything that was said of him was true. He was careful with his coin, but not niggardly. It was not humorless at all, though his humour had an edge to it, sharp as a knife. His sons and daughter and the people of Winterfell seemed to love him well enough. Once the initial frost had thawed, his lordship took the queen hunting after elk and wild boar in the wolf's wood, showed her the bones of a giant, and allowed her to rummage as she pleased through his modest castle library. He even deigned to approach Silverwing, though warily. The women of Winterfell were taken by the queen's charms as well, once they grew to know her. Her grace became particularly close with Lord Alaric's daughter, Alara. When the rest of the queen's party finally turned up at the castle gates, after struggling through trackless bogs and summer snows, the meat and mead flowed freely, despite the king's absence. Things were not going as well at King's Landing, meanwhile. The peace talks dragged on far longer than anticipated, for the acrimony between the two free cities ran deeper than Jaehaerys had known. When His Grace attempted to strike a balance, both sides accused him of favouring the other. Whilst the prince and the archon dickered, fights began to break out between their men across the city, in inns, brothels, and wine sinks. A Pentoshe guardsman was set upon and killed, and 3 nights later the archon's own galley was set afire where she was docked. The king's departure was delayed, and delayed again. In the north, Queen Alysanne grew restless with waiting, and decided to take her leave of Winterfell for a time and visit the men of the Night's Watch at Castle Black. The distance was not negligible, even flying. Her Grace landed at the last hearth, and several smaller keeps and holdfasts on her way, to the surprise and delight of their lords, whilst a portion of her tail scrambled after her. The rest remained at Winterfell. Her first sight of the wall from above took Alysanne's breath away, Her Grace would later tell the king. There had been some concern how the queen might be received at Castle Black, for many of the Black brothers had been poor fellows and warriors' sons before those orders were abolished. But Lord Stark sent ravens ahead to warn of her coming, and the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, Lothar Burley, assembled 800 of his finest men to receive her. That night, the Black brothers feasted the queen on mammoth meat, washed down with mead and stout. As dawn broke the next day, Lord Burley took Her Grace to the top of the wall. "Here the world ends," he told her, gesturing at the vast green expanse of the haunted forest beyond. Burley was apologetic for the quality of the food and drink presented to the queen, and the rudeness of the accommodations at Castle Black. "We do what we can, Your Grace," the Lord Commander explained, "but our beds are hard, our halls are cold, and our food is nourishing," the queen finished. "And that is all that I require. It will please me to eat as you do." The men of the Night's Watch were as thunderstruck by the queen's dragon as the people of White Harbour had been, though the queen herself noted that Silverwing does not like this wall. Though it was summer and the wall was weeping, the chill of the ice could still be felt whenever the wind blew, and every gust would make the dragon hiss and snap. "Thrice I flew Silverwing high above Castle Black, and thrice I tried to take her north beyond the wall," Alysanne wrote to Jaehaerys. "But every time she veered back south again and refused to go. Never before has she refused to take me where I wished to go. I laughed about it when I came down again, so the Black brothers would not realize anything was amiss. But it troubled me then, and it troubles me still." At Castle Black, the queen saw her first wildlings. A raiding party had been taken not long before, trying to scale the wall, and a dozen ragged survivors of the fight had been confined in cages for her inspection. When Her Grace asked what was to be done with them, she was told that they would have their ears cut off, before being turned loose north of the wall. "All but those three," her escort said, pointing out 3 prisoners who had already lost their ears. "We'll take the heads off those 3. They've been caught once already." If the others were wise, he told the queen, they would take the loss of their ears as a lesson and keep to their side of the wall. "Most don't, though," he added. 3 of the brothers had been singers before taking the Black, and they took turns playing for Her Grace at night, regaling her with ballads, war songs, and bawdy barracks tunes. Lord Commander Burley himself took the queen into the haunted forest, with 100 rangers riding escort. When Alysanne expressed the wish to see some of the other forts along the wall, The first ranger, Benton Glover, led her west atop the wall, past Snowgate to the Night Fort, where they made their descent and spent the night. The ride, the Queen decided, was as breathtaking a journey as she had ever experienced. As exhilarating as it was cold, though the wind up there blows so strongly that I feared it was about to sweep us off the wall. The Night Fort itself she found grim and sinister. It is so huge the men seem dwarfed by it, like mice in a ruined hall, she told Jaehaerys. And there is a darkness there, a taste in the air. I was so glad to leave that place. It must not be thought that the Queen's days and nights at Castle Black were entirely taken up with such idle pursuits. She was here for the Iron Throne, she reminded Lord Burley, and many an afternoon was spent with him and his officers discussing the wildlings, the wall, and the needs of the watch. Above all else, a queen must know how to listen, Alysanne Targaryen often said. At Castle Black she proved those words. She listened, she heard, and she won the eternal devotion of the men of the Night's Watch by her actions. She understood the need for a castle between Snowgate and Icemark, she told Lord Burley, but the Night Fort was crumbling, overlarge and surely ruinous to heat. The watch should abandon it, she said, and build a smaller castle farther to the east. Lord Burley could not disagree, but the Night's Watch lacked the coin to build new castles, he said. Alysanne had anticipated that objection. She would pay for the castle herself, she told the Lord Commander, and pledged her jewels to cover the cost. I have a good many jewels, she said. It would take 8 years to raise the new castle, which would bear the name of Deep Lake. Outside its main hall, a statue of Alysanne Targaryen stands to this very day. The Night Fort was abandoned even before Deep Lake was completed, as the Queen had wished. Lord Commander Burley also renamed Snowgate Castle in her honour, as Queensgate. Queen Alysanne also wished to listen to the women of the North. When Lord Burley explained that there were no women on the wall, she persisted, until finally, with great reluctance, he had her escorted to a village south of the wall that the Black Brothers called Mole's Town. She would find women there, his lordship said, though most of them would be harlots. The men of the Night's Watch took no wives, he explained, but they remained men all the same, and some felt certain needs. Queen Alysanne said she did not care, and so it came to pass that she held her women's court amongst the halls and strumpets of Molestown, and there heard certain tales that would change the Seven Kingdoms forever. Back in King's Landing, the Archon of Tyrosh, the Prince of Pentos, and Jaehaerys I, Targaryen of Westeros, finally put their seals to a treaty of eternal peace. That a pact was reached at all was considered somewhat of a miracle, and largely due to the king's veiled hint that Westeros itself might enter the war if an accord was not reached. The aftermath would prove even less successful than the negotiations. On his return to Tyrosh, the Archon was heard to say that King's Landing was a reeking sore, not fit to be called a city, whilst the Magisters of Pentos were so unhappy with the terms that they sacrificed their prince to their queer gods, as is the custom of that city. Only then was King Jaehaerys free to fly north with Vermithor. He and the Queen reunited at Winterfell after half a year apart. The king's time at Winterfell began on an ominous note. Upon his arrival, Alaric Stark led his grace down to the crypts below the castle to show him his brother's tomb. Walton lies down here in darkness in no small part thanks to you. Stars and swords, the leavings of your seven gods, what are they to us? And yet you sent them to the wall in their hundreds and their thousands, so many that the Night's Watch was hard-pressed to feed them. And when the worst of them rose up, the oathbreakers you had sent us, it cost my brother's life to put them down. A grievous price, the king agreed. But that was never our intent. You have my regrets, my lord, and my gratitude. I would sooner have my brother, Lord Alaric answered darkly. Lord Stark and King Jaehaerys would never be fast friends. The shade of Walton Stark remained between them to the end. It was only through Queen Alysanne's good offices that they ever found accord. The Queen had visited Brandon's Gift, the lands south of the wall that Brandon the Builder had granted to the Watch for their support and sustenance. "It is not enough," she told the king. "The soil is thin and stony, the hills unpopulated. The watch lacks for coin, and when winter comes they will lack for food as well." The answer she proposed was a new gift, a further strip of land south of Brandon's gift. The notion did not please Lord Alaric. Though a strong friend to the Night's Watch, he knew that the lords who presently held the lands in question would object to them being given away without their leave. "I have no doubt that you can persuade them, Lord Alaric," the queen said. And finally, charmed by her as ever, Alaric Stark agreed that aye, he could. And so it came to pass that the size of the gift was doubled with a stroke. A little more need be said of the time Queen Alysanne and King Jaehaerys spent in the north. After lingering in Winterfell for another fortnight, they made their way to Torrens Square, and thence to Barrowton, where Lord Dustin showed them the barrow of the First King, and staged somewhat of a tourney in their honour, though it was a poor thing compared to the tourneys of the south. From there, Vermithor and Silverwing bore Jaehaerys and Alysanne back again to King's Landing. The men and women of their retinue had a more arduous journey home, travelling overland from Barrowton back to White Harbour and taking ship from there. Even before the others reached White Harbour, King Jaehaerys had called together his council in the Red Keep to consider an entreaty from his queen. When Septon Barth, Grand Maester Bennifer and the others had assembled, Alysanne told them of her visit to the Wall, and the day that she had spent with the whores and fallen women of Molestown. "There was a girl there," the queen said, "no older than I am as I sit before you now. A pretty girl, but not, I think, as pretty as she was. Her father was a blacksmith, and when she was a maid of 14 years he gave her hand in marriage to his apprentice. She was fond of the boy, and he of her, so the two of them were duly wed. But scarcely had they said their vows, than their lord came down upon the wedding with his men-at-arms to claim his right to her first knight. He carried her off to his tower and enjoyed her, and the next morning his men returned her to her husband. But her maidenhead was gone, together with whatever love the apprentice boy had borne her. He could not raise his hand against the lord for peril of his life, so instead he raised it against his wife. When it became plain that she was carrying the lord's child, he beat it out of her. From that day on, he never called her anything but whore, until finally the girl decided that if she must be called a whore, she would live as one, and made her way to Molestown. There she dwells until this day, a sad child, ruined. But all the while, in other villages, other maids are being wed, and other lords are claiming their first knight." Hers was the worst story, but not the only one. At White Harbour, at Molestown, at Barrowton, other women spoke of their first knights as well. "I never knew, my lords." "Oh, I knew of the tradition. Even on Dragonstone there are stories of men of mine own house, Targaryens, who have made free with the wives of fisherfolk and serving men, and sired children on them. Dragon seeds, they call them," Jaehaerys said with obvious reluctance. "It is not a thing to boast of, but it has happened, mayhaps more often than we would care to admit. Such children are cherished, though. Oris Baratheon himself was a dragon seed, a bastard brother to our grandsire. Whether he was conceived of a first knight I cannot say, but Lord Arryon was his father, that was well known. Gifts were given." "Gifts," the queen said in a voice sharp with derision. "I see no honour in any of this. I knew such things happened hundreds of years ago, I confess it, but I never dreamed that the custom endured so strongly to this day. Mayhaps I did not want to know. I closed my eyes, but that poor girl in Molestown opened them. The right of the first knight. Your Grace, my lords, it is time we put an end to this. I beg you." A silence fell after the queen had finished speaking, Grand Maester Bennifer tells us. The lords of the small council shifted awkwardly in their seats and exchanged glances, until finally the king himself spoke up, sympathetic but reluctant. What the queen proposed would be difficult, Jaehaerys said. Lords grew troublesome when kings began taking things that they regarded as their own. Their lands, their gold, their rights.
Their wives? Alysanne finished.
I remember our wedding, my lord. If you had been a blacksmith and me a washerwoman and some lord had come to claim me and take my maidenhead the day we took our vows, what would you have done?
Killed him, Jeheris said.
But I am not a blacksmith.
If, I said, the queen persisted, a blacksmith is still a man, is he not?
What man but a coward would stand by meekly whilst another man has his way with his wife? We do not want blacksmiths killing lords, surely.
She turned to Grand Maester Benefer and said, I know how Gargon Coheris died,
Gargon the guest. How many more such instances have there been, I wonder?
More than I would care to say, Benefer allowed. They are not oft spoken of, for fear that other men might do the same, but
the first knight is an offence against the king's peace, the queen concluded. An offence against not only the maid, but her husband as well. And the wife of the lord, never forget. What do those high-born ladies do, whilst their lords are out deflowering maidens? Do they sew, sing, pray?
Were it me, I might pray my lord husband fell off his horse and broke his neck coming home.
King Jeheris smiled at that, but it was plain that he was becoming increasingly uncomfortable.
The right of the first knight is an ancient one, he argued, though with no great passion. As much a part of lordship as the right of pit and gallows. It is rarely used, south of the neck, I am told, but its continued existence is a lordly prerogative that some of my more truculent subjects would be loath to surrender.
You are not wrong, my love, but sometimes it is best to let a sleeping dragon lie.
We are the sleeping dragons, the queen threw back. These lords who love their first knights are dogs. Why must they slake their lust on maidens who've only just pledged their love to other men? Have they no wives of their own? Are there no whores in their domains? Have they lost the use of their hands?
The justiciar, Lord Albin Massey, spoke up then, saying, There is more to the first knight than lust, your grace. The practice is an ancient one, older than the Andals, older than the faith. It goes back to the Dawn Age, I do not doubt. The first men were a savage race, and like the wildlings beyond the wall, they followed only strength. Their lords and kings were warriors, mighty men and heroes, and they wanted their sons to be the same. If a warlord chose to bestow his seed upon some maid on her wedding night, it was seen as a sort of blessing. And if a child should come of the coupling, so much the better. The husband could then claim the honour of raising a hero's son as his own.
Mayhaps that was so 10,000 years ago, the queen replied. But the lords claiming the first knight now are no heroes.
You have not heard the women speak of them.
I have. Old men, fat men, cruel men, poxy boys, rapers, droolers, men covered with scabs, with scars, with boils, lords who have not washed in half a year, men with greasy hair and lice. These are your mighty men.
I listened to the girls, and none of them felt blessed.
The Andals never practiced the first knight in Andalos, Grand Maester Benefer said. When they came to Westeros and swept away the kingdoms of the first men, they found the tradition in place and chose to let it remain, just as they did the Godswoods.
Septon Bath spoke then, turning to the king.
Sire, if I may be so bold, I believe Her Grace has the right of this.
The first men might have found some purpose in this rite, but the first men fought with bronze swords and fed their weirwood trees with blood. We are not those men, and it is past time we put an end to this evil. It stands against every ideal of chivalry. Our knights swear to protect the innocence of maidens, save for when the lord they serve wishes to despoil one, it would seem. We swear our marriage vows before the father and the mother, promising fidelity until the stranger comes to part us, and nowhere in the seven-pointed star does it say that those promises do not apply to lords.
You are not wrong, your grace. Some lords will surely grumble at this, especially in the north. But all the maids will thank us for it, and all the husbands, and the fathers, and the mothers, just as the queen has said. I know the faithful will be pleased. His High Holiness will let his voice be heard, never doubt it.
When Barth had finished speaking, Jeheris Targaryen threw up his hands.
I know when I am beaten.
Very well, Let it be done. And so it came to pass that the second of what the small folk named Queen Alisande's laws was enacted, the abolition of the lord's ancient right to the first knight. Henceforth it was decreed a bride's maidenhead would belong only to her husband, whether joined before a septon or a heart tree, and any man, be he lord or peasant, who took her on her wedding night or any other night, would be guilty of the crime of rape. As the 58th year after Aegon's conquest drew to a close, King Jairus celebrated the 10th anniversary of his coronation at the Starry Sept of Old Town. The callow boy that the High Septon had crowned that day was long gone. His place had been taken by a man of 24 who was every inch a king. The wispy beard and moustache that his grace had cultivated early in his reign had become a handsome golden beard, shot through with silver. His unshorn hair he wore in a thick braid that fell almost to his waist. Tall and handsome, Jairus moved with an easy grace, be it on the dance floor or in the training yard. His smile, it was said, could warm the heart of any maiden in the Seven Kingdoms. His frown could make a man's blood run cold. In his sister he had a queen even more beloved than he was. Good Queen Alisande, the small folk called her, from Old Town to the Wall. The gods had blessed the two of them with 3 strong children, 2 splendid young princes, and a princess who was the darling of the realm. In their decade of rule, they had known grief and horror, betrayal and conflict, and the death of loved ones, but they had weathered the storms and survived the tragedies and emerged stronger and better from all they had endured. Their accomplishments were undeniable. The 7 kingdoms were at peace, and more prosperous than they had been in living memory. It was a time for celebration, and celebrate they did with a tourney at King's Landing on the anniversary of the king's coronation. Princess Daenerys and the princes Aemon and Balon shared the royal box with their mother and father and revelled in the cheers of the crowd. On the field, the highlight of the competition was the brilliance of Sir Ryan Redwine, the youngest son of Lord Manfred Redwine of the Arbor, Jairus's Lord Admiral and Master of Ships. In successive tilts, Sir Ryan unhorsed Ronald Baratheon, Arthur Oakheart, Simon Dondarrion, Harris Hogg, Harry the Ham, to the Commons, and 2 Kingsguard knights, Lawrence Roxton and Lucamore Strong. When the young gallant trotted up to the royal box and crowned good Queen Alisande as his Queen of Love and Beauty, the Commons roared their approval. The leaves in the trees had begun to turn russet and orange and gold, and the ladies of the court wore gowns to match. At the feast that followed the end of the tourney, Lord Rhaegar Baratheon appeared, with his children, Boromund and Jocelyn, to be warmly embraced by the king and queen. Lords from all over the realm came to join the celebration. Lyman Lannister from Casterly Rock, Daemon Valerian from Driftmark, Prentice Tully from Riverrun, Roderick Arryn from the Vale, even the Lords Rowan and Oakheart, whose levies once marched with Septon Moon. Theomore Manderly came down from the north. Alaric Stark did not, but his sons came, and with them his daughter Alara, blushing to take up her new duties as a lady-in-waiting to the queen. The High Septon was too ill to come, but he sent his newest scepter, Rhaelar, who had been Targaryen, still shy, but smiling. It was said that the queen wept for joy at the sight of her, for in her face and form she was the very image of her sister Arya, grown older. It was a time for warm embraces, for smiles, for toasts and reconciliations, for renewing old friendships and making new ones, for laughter and kisses. It was a good time, a golden autumn, a time of peace and plenty. But winter was coming. The Long Reign, Jairus and Alisande, Policy, Progeny and Pain. On the 7th day of the 59th year after Aegon's conquest, a battered ship came limping up the Whispering Sound to the port of Old Town. Her sails were patched and ragged and salt-stained, her paint faded and flaking, the banner streaming from her mast so sun-bleached as to be unrecognizable.
Not until she was tied up at dock was she finally recognized in her sorry state. She was the Lady Meredith, last seen departing Old Town almost 3 years earlier to cross the Sunset Sea.